Simon & Schuster Audio presents From the Ashes, My Story of Being Métis, Homeless, and Finding My Way by Jesse Thistle. Read by the author.
This book is dedicated to the families whose loved ones are taken, or disappeared, or lost to them. Those forever watching for their loved one to return home. I watch and wait with you. It is also dedicated to Indigenous children who grew up with no sense of themselves through projects like the 60 Scoop, residential schools, adoption, or other such separation from their nuclear family during which they were robbed of their Indigenous identity, through no fault of their own. The pages of this book speak to the damage colonialism can do to Indigenous families and how, when one's indigeneity is stripped away, people can make poor choices informed by pain, loneliness, and heartbreak, choices that see them eventually cast upon the streets, in jail, or wandering with no place to be. I dedicate this book to you. I walk with you. I love you. I know the loneliness and frustration you endure. Lastly, I dedicate this book to my wife, Lucy, who loved me back into the circle. This also goes out to my brothers, Josh, Jerry, and Daniel, my mom and dad, and to my grandparents, who gave me a fighting chance. Our circle is strong. Our fire burns. This book is but a torch from the hearth of our clans, and is hopefully enough to light the way for others to follow. Indigenous Affairs. At night, alone, when the dope sickness set in and the begging became too humiliating, I'd wander from the Byward Market to the Centennial Flame Fountain on Parliament Hill, looking for respite from my addictions. Ashamed, I sat with my back to the Peace Tower, thrust my hand in the cool fountain water, fishing out the hoard of coins thrown by tourists and passers-by. The RCMP who guarded the fountain always saw me coming, from way down at the bottom of Rideau Hill, near the Milestones and Chateau Laurier, but he never stopped me. Instead, he'd sit and wait for me, watch as I shoveled wet change into my pockets. Then, before I got too greedy, rush out and chase me away. He always let me escape. We both understood what was going on, why I was there, stealing from the Centennial Flame. Prologue. The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. Matthew 11:12. The dead silent scream danger. Frenzied squeaks of jail-issued blue deck shoes on seal cement followed by wet smacks, fast pops, loud cracks, and finally a dull thud confirmed it. A guy lay crumpled on the range floor, our quartermaster told us. He wasn't conscious. His legs were seized straight, quivering uncontrollably. He had pissed and shit himself. We didn't need to see it with our own eyes. The unseen, the unknown in jail is often worse than the seen, the known. The next day after cell search, I heard that he had died en route to hospital. Someone said he'd stolen a bag of chips from another inmate's canteen, but who knew? Who cared? It was jail justice. The thief got what he deserved. According to us, according to society, at least that's what I told myself. All I knew for sure was that I didn't know anything, and I hadn't seen anything. I'd only heard it. But I wouldn't even tell the guards that much. I had to survive. And the only way you did that was by keeping your mouth shut, turning your head away. What was I doing here in jail anyway? Why had I put myself in the midst of this filth and horrible violence? The answer was simple. I did it to save my leg and my life. Lost and alone. 1979 to 1987. A Little Boy's Dream. I had this tiny bag. Had it since my family fell apart. It was red and blue with an Adidas logo on the side. And a golden zipper. The zipper of all zippers. I had this tiny bag. I took it everywhere with me. When we moved with Dad, hopped out windows at night, when we ran and ran, on to our next place. I had this tiny bag. Grandma asked me to unpack it, but I wouldn't do it. She asked me many times after that, but I kept it filled with all my things, tucked away, under my bed, just in case. I had this tiny bag. It had my old life inside. When I finally got the courage to get rid of it, I left it on my bed, then jumped out my window, down 2 stories, but the grass broke my fall. "Why did you do that, baby boy?" Grandma asked. "Because I always dream of dying," I said, "and I can't take it to heaven with me." Road allowance. My cook'em Nancy's palm felt leathery in mine as we walked along the train tracks. Stands of poplar swayed and bent in the wind, and she stood still for a second to catch her bearings and watch the flat-bottomed late spring clouds slouch by. She mumbled, then began thrusting her gnarled walking stick in the tall brush ahead, spreading it open, looking for flashes of purple or blue. Purple was a clear sign that the pregnant Saskatoon berry bushes were ready to give birth and ease the winter suffering of bears, birds, and humans. Berries, Cookham said, knew well their role as life-givers, and we had to honor and respect that. We did that by knowing our role as responsible harvesters, picking only what we needed, and leaving the rest for our animal kin so they could feed themselves and their young. That was our pact, she said, and if we followed it, they'd never let us down. My cook'em wore brownish-yellow eyeglasses the size of teacup saucers, but her eyes could still see things my 3-year-old eyes couldn't. I always tried to search out berry patches before she did, but she always got there first. Always. As we waded deeper through the railside grass and reeds, a vast fleet of mosquitoes and gnats lifted from the ditch floor and enveloped our heads. A few flew into my mouth, choking me. I coughed and batted at the air. "No, Jesse." Cookham grabbed my arms and held them. "They are our relatives. Never do that." I'd never seen her angry before, but she was now. As the black cloud intensified around us, she drew in a deep breath, closed her eyes, and spoke softly in Michif. She pointed to me and our half pail of berries, and then to the rat root plant that protruded out of her dress pocket. Her voice sounded like warm summer air swooshing over the open prairie right before rain comes, and reminded me of when I'd accidentally disturbed the hornet's nest behind the smoke shed. There was no anger in her voice then. The plume of insects hovered mid-air for a second, then flew skyward and dispersed, just like the hornets had done. I looked at her in amazement, and my mouth opened, but no sound came out. I strained to hear any buzzing, but there was only the call of a loon far in the distance, followed by the shuffle of Cookham's moccasins. "Oh, my silent one," Cookham said. "I just told them that we have a job to do." Her brown face cracked into a smile. "I asked them to visit us later, if they must, but for now we need to concentrate." She brushed a few strands of hair from my face and hoisted me over a puddle. "Or maybe they're right. Maybe it's quitting time. Let's get back, Chi Garçon. We have enough to make a good bannock." I love Cookham's bannock more than anything. Even harvesting with her, listening to her stories, or hearing her sing. She made it whenever we visited. We lived in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, about an hour's drive from my grandparents. Their cabin was in Aaron Ferry, near Debden, just south of Big River, between the old Highway No. 1 on one side and the new Highway 55 on the other. The CN rail cut right up the center of the road allowance, connecting Debden to Big River and on to the rest of Saskatchewan. My grandparents' log cabin wasn't like any other place I knew. Mom told us that her dad, Musham Jeremy Morissette, had made it by hand from the surrounding aspen hardwood after our family lost our homestead in Park Valley, a few kilometers away. It took him one season to fell the trees, strip them of bark, and build it, and another half season to chink in the cracks with mud and moss, waterproof the roof, and make it ready for winter living. Nobody else had a neat house like my cook'em and Musham, way out in the country in the middle of nowhere, with no water or electricity. Musham said there weren't many people like us anymore, rebels, who fended for themselves. Maybe a few Arcan relatives down the road, but that was about it. The rest had sold out and got farms or went to the city to find work. He didn't own his land. It belonged to the Queen of England. "She doesn't mind us being here," Musham said, "and it lets me hunt and trap freely and be my own boss, which I like." He told us stories about how our people once lived in large communities and handmade houses just like his all over Saskatchewan, living off the land, but that was before the government attacked us and stole our land during the resistance, before our clans fell apart. I couldn't understand what he was talking about. I tried imagining villages of our people living like he and my cook'em did, in their little log house, all squished onto little pieces of land owned by the Queen, and I couldn't. But there were beaver, muskrat, deer, bears, elk, and fish everywhere, forests, streams, and rivers all around to play in, and no neighbors for miles and miles. "If someone tries to push us around, we just pick up and move somewhere else," Musham said. "We live like this to be free, like our ancestors." I understood that. When Cook'em and I came back from berry picking, Musham was standing at the front door of the cabin. The elk horn buttons that fastened his beige leather vest strained to hold it together over his rounded stomach. Cook'em made all of Musham's clothes from animals he trapped and materials she traded for in Debden on her monthly visit to town. "Where are Blanche and Sonny?" Cook'em called to him, her brow wrinkling. My parents' car had been in the driveway when we left to go berry picking, but now there was just my Musham's plump horse drinking from the trough at the side of the house. "They went into town. Should be back soon. Fire's ready, though." Cook'em nodded, picked up a pail of rainwater for the washing, and nudged Musham aside as she carried it inside. The smell of burnt hardwood licked all around my grandfather's bald head as he bent down to hug me. The press of his fancy vest against my exposed belly felt like thousands of soft pebbles. Blazes of prairie roses, windflowers, blue stems, hyssops, lead plants, and asters decorated his clothing in beaded patterns that Cook'em said were passed down to her from her Michif Nihil ancestors, mothers to daughters, for over two centuries. When Musham played the fiddle at night, I loved watching moonbeams flicker over his beads. It looked like he was wearing rubies and diamonds all over. And when he tapped his feet to the rhythm of the reels, he told us were passed down from his grandfather's grandfather, the light lulled me to sleep. Josh and Jerry were inside the cabin playing on the floor with the wooden toys Musham had carved for them while we were out. Jerry's was a captain's sword, and Josh's was a little marionette man that jigged when you held the stick that protruded out its back. Musham could carve these things in 5 minutes flat. Jerry always got the best toys because Jerry was his favorite grandson, being his namesake and all. Sometimes Josh and I would get jealous of Jerry. He crawled all over Musham's stomach and they both bellowed until tears came out of their eyes. Or Musham would take Jerry into the woods to show him his traps and a thing or two about snaring rabbits. He never did that with us. He'd hug us, but it wasn't the same. Jerry even kind of looked like him, stout, thick-legged, and broad across the shoulders. He was like Musham, too, powerful, strong-willed, and stubborn. Josh was tall and thin. Out of us all, he looked the most Indian, or at least that's what my mom would say when she brushed his long black hair in the morning. She always took her time with Josh, and I could see that he was her favorite. His skin was much darker than Jerry's and mine, and he looked more like Mom than Dad, Korean or Japanese almost. Everyone was proud of Josh. He was the oldest and smartest and talked the most, and whatever new clothes we got from our aunts and uncles went to him. I'd eventually get them, but not until after Josh and Jerry. I was much smaller and skinnier than both of my brothers and had blonde, shoulder-length hair. My skin looked like my father's, pinkish cream. People were always saying, "He looks like a little white boy," or, "You sure he wasn't switched at the hospital?" Mom said that it didn't matter, because I was special. She said that I was the largest of all her babies, a little over 10 pounds when I was born in 1976, as long as a carnival hot dog with a huge oblong head. And the doctors were shocked when I came out. "You didn't make a sound," Mom said. "No screams or whimpers or nothing, just a wet plop sound." I stayed quiet for my first 3 years. The most noise I'd make was a cry or an incomprehensible squeal of excitement. "Look here," Musham said as he placed me on the floor with my brothers. He pulled a small wooden knife out of his back pocket. It was just little enough for me to grasp. I waved it in front of him, and he jumped back. Jerry charged at me, coming to Musham's rescue. Musham scooped him up before he could impale me with his wooden saber. Heat and the smell of lard radiated from the wood stove. Cookham opened its door to chuck in a few logs, and the muscles on her arms rippled. She was strong. One time a dog almost bit Josh near the road, and Cookham threw a cast iron skillet at it with one flick of her wrist, like a ninja star. The skillet whistled 30 feet in the air, and the dog ran into the forest whining, and never bugged any of us again. I watched as she wiped the dirt off her hands and put a rolled-up bannock ball in the skillet. As they hissed and spit in the air, I could hear my parents' car screeching to a stop outside. They were fighting, like always. Musham said something to Cookham in Cree. I thought she was going to toss the frying pan, oil and all, out the door at my dad. She just wagged her head, though. Mom leaned in the front door and announced, "We're going home, boys. Pull your stuff together." Dad didn't come in. I peeked out the door. Music was blasting from the car. The windows were rolled up, and the inside was flooded with smoke. "But Blanche," Cookham said, "we've picked berries for the bannock." "Can't, Mom," she said. "Sonny needs to get back. Damn idiot's got to meet someone. Come, boys, hurry it up." My mother was just 15 when she met my father in 1973 at her sister Bernadette's house in Debden, Saskatchewan. According to my aunties, my mother was just about the prettiest native girl in all of northern Saskatchewan. A Mischief Audrey Hepburn, crossed with Grace Kelly and Hedy Lamarr. Silken black hair down to her waist, jet black eyes, and a smile like a midnight flame. They said men hovered around her like moths, and that when Dad first laid eyes on her, he tripped all over himself to catch her. He chatted her up, bought her stuff, and fawned over her. "He looked like a bumbling fool," my auntie said. All the men did. But Dad was different. He was an Algonquin Scot, although my uncles tell me he knew himself as a white man. He wasn't much to look at. Chubby around the middle, with a pockmarked face and broken fighter's teeth, and his usual jean outfit was slick with traveler's patina. But there was something charming about him, an ability to talk and a boldness. That apparently came from his rough blue-collar upbringing north of Toronto, where he learned to hustle or perish. He also loved rock music, Deep Purple, Foghat, Jethro Tull, Black Sabbath, Johnny and Edgar Winter. He knew all their songs and more, how they were written, and the stories behind their creation. Mom was stuck in the 1950s, listening to old country music, the Carter family, Patsy Cline, Hank Williams, Bill Monroe, Don Messer, anyone of the sort. She did know some modern music, Bob Dylan, The Doors, The Guess Who, Joni Mitchell, but she couldn't match my father. My auntie said Mom told them Dad was like a jukebox, with info on all the hottest bands. That made him like a god in northern Saskatchewan, where no one knew anything about rock or Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix or anything. It made him irresistible, Mom said. The side of my mother's face was blue. It wasn't that way before she left. And her voice sounded the way I didn't like. Musham examined her, and I knew he could see her broken glasses sticking out of her pocket when she went into the back room. He pushed himself up from the table, swore, and reached for his axe. I thought he was going to kill my dad. Josh, Jerry, and I all started crying. "Stop, Jeremy," Cookham yelled. She pulled the axe out of his hand and threw it beside the stove. "This is between them," she said, her voice sounding the way it did when she had spoken with the mosquitoes. Musham sneered, then stared out the window. Dad didn't notice. I could see him drumming his hands against the steering wheel. Mom came back with some things. "Sorry, Mom, Dad. Next time we'll stay for Bannock." She picked up our toys, then piled us into the car. She was like a whirlwind. We didn't even have the chance to say goodbye. As soon as we were in the car, Dad floored it. The wheels kicked up a cloud of dirt, and I could just see my Cookham and Musham waving to us through it. Hornet. Dad burst through the apartment door, his dirty blonde mullet in full flight. He was grinning so widely his greasy handlebar mustache splayed out at both ends. In his hands were a coffee tin and a white plastic bag. "Daddy got paid, boys." He placed his bounty on the cardboard box that served as our coffee table, then fell backward into the sofa. A plume of sour dust erupted from the cushions. The tin rattled, and a nickel spilled out over the edge and rolled a foot or two towards us. When Dad opened his arms for a hug, Josh ran from his usual spot in front of the TV and grabbed his legs. Jerry and I were still watching television, a shark attacking an octopus on the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. A red cloud of ink filled the ocean water. As the octopus scurried to safety, we joined Josh and hugged Dad. "I did what you said," Josh said. He still clung to Dad's jeans. "I kept an eye out and made sure no one came in the apartment while you were gone." Josh was in charge of Jerry and me whenever Dad left us alone to go on a mission. He was 5. "Make sure to feed your brothers," Dad would say. "Don't let no one in. Hide in the vent behind your bed if anyone gets in. And don't turn the light on at night because they'll know you're inside. Got it?" Josh always nodded. Even 4-year-old Jerry was my boss. We were like a little tribe with Josh as our chief, Jerry as second in command, and me as the expendable warrior. I had to do the bidding of both. They made me stand on the chair to check the peephole when someone was at the door. They made me fish poo out of the toilet to smear on the walls to get even with Dad for leaving us alone. And they always made me climb onto the counter to reach where Dad hid all the best food away in the top cupboard. It was dangerous to climb so high, but I was good. And I was never afraid of heights like Jerry or Josh were. Climbing came naturally, and the distance between me and the floor excited me and made me feel powerful. It was something my brothers couldn't do. Dad would freak out when he found that we'd eaten his secret food. Cans of Spam, peanut butter, loaves of bread, chips, and the odd jar of Cheese Whiz, which he never shared. And I always got the blame because I never talked, even when I played alone with my brothers, and even when I got a licking. Mom used to think that I was mute, but I could speak fine. I just chose not to. My words belonged to me, They were the only thing I had that were mine. And I didn't trust anyone enough to share them. Dad was only gone for a night this time, but in the kitchen, the cupboards only had a few unopened cans of beans and beets he'd gotten from the local food bank a few days before. Empty boxes of crackers and cans piled one on top of another, covering the countertops and cascading out over the stovetop. The fridge had a few half-drunk beer bottles, an old light bulb, and a hardened turnip. Sometimes he'd go away for 2 or 3 days and leave us with nothing. "Good boy," Dad rubbed Josh's head, then pushed the three of us off of him. Josh, Jerry, and I fell to the beer-stained carpet like puppies bucked off their mom's teat as Dad cradled his bag. My mother had abandoned my father, my brothers, and me. That was the version of the story we were made to believe by my father's family. But it wasn't the whole picture. Mom married Dad when she was just 17, and my father was 22. She gave him an ultimatum the day of their wedding. "Quit drinking and running around, or I'll leave you." He promised her a life of sobriety. Dad lasted 3 days before he drank himself into a stupor. One day he took his anger out on everyone. Josh endured a beating, and Mom received it even worse. Mom had had enough of moving from apartment to apartment, room to room, of my dad wasting all the money and opportunity that came their way. She'd had enough of all the bullshit. She packed our bags while Dad was passed out on the couch, and the four of us moved to Moose Jaw. Mom went to night school and began working at a local restaurant during the day. Life was steady. We stayed in one apartment, slept in beds instead of on piles of laundry, and ate frequent meals. And Mom didn't cry herself to sleep with bruises like before. One day Dad showed up. He was healthy, coherent, and his clothes were clean. He charmed his way through the front door, telling Mom he'd found a great job back east with his father, that he wasn't drinking and drugging, and that he'd found an apartment and could afford to keep us boys if she allowed us to go with him. He wasn't trying to get her back. He knew not to go there. "I'll return them after a few months. You have my word, Blanche." I think Mom decided to let us go with Dad because she wasn't thinking straight. She was exhausted. And Dad knew how to sound convincing when he wanted something and could exploit Mom's weaknesses. He had skills from years and years of hustling. Mom let us go. I could smell the pine scent in her hair as we hugged goodbye on the veranda. I didn't blame her. Dad could sell the Brooklyn Bridge to New York City officials if he really wanted to, or so people said. He was just that good at lying. "Look here," Dad said as he broke open the bag and an avalanche of cigarette butts spilled onto the floor. He grabbed my brother's arm and placed him in front of the butts beside the TV. "Jerry, you roll the best. Take my zigzags and do like before." Jerry peeled out a rolling paper and set to work ripping open the largest butts onto a sheet of paper. The smell of moldy smokes filled the apartment. Dad then poured the contents of the tin onto the carpet. The coins were like falling treasure and Dad looked like a pirate, like Captain Hook in the Peter Pan book Mom used to read us before bed. "Josh, count 'em up," he said. "Jesse knows what pennies are. Just let him pick them out before you get started." Josh nodded and got my attention. "Like last time, Jesse, remember?" He held up a penny and told me to dig. I shoved my hand in the pile and began picking out what looked like, to me, nuggets of gold. "Dad," Josh said before we got too far, "we haven't eaten since yesterday morning, and it's nighttime now. We're hungry. Did you bring anything?" "Shit, I forgot. Count it up. We'll go to the store and get something after. Promise." I watched as he pulled a small baggie filled with white powder out of his jean jacket pocket. He held it up to the light and flicked it, then made his way to the washroom and slammed the door. Josh sighed and began helping me. My stomach gurgled. He looked over at me. It was Josh's job to feed us. Sometimes he'd leave Jerry and me alone for a while and walk to the convenience store to beg for money to buy food. We'd seen Dad do it and knew how to do it, too. It usually took Josh a couple of hours, but he always came back with chips and pop and other goodies. He was my hero, my chief. Sometimes when we got really hungry, Josh even took Jerry and me over to ask for change in front of the hockey arena around the block. It was the best spot because we could buy gigantic hot dogs there. We shared bites. The hot meat burst with such flavor that my jaw would ache up around my ears, and my tongue swam in pools of saliva. Drool would sometimes spill out of my mouth onto my shirt before I even took a bite. Dad's treasure shimmered in front of the TV. The wildlife program was still playing, and a whale drifted through blue water, calmly scooping mouthfuls of food as Josh and I rifled through the silver and gold pile. And images of those hot dogs piled high with ketchup and mustard and relish and everything floated through my mind. I noticed light peeping out of the washroom. Dad must have slammed the door so hard it bounced open a crack. I dropped the gold pennies I had in my hand and crawled over quietly to see what he was doing. Josh trailed behind. Dad was on the toilet, hunched over with a spoon in one hand, a blue lighter in the other. Red flames licked the bottom of the spoon and bubbles spit droplets into the air. Dad's forehead was wet. Sweat dripped onto the tile floor, and that see-through thingy I'd found underneath the sofa was by his side. Dad had told me it was a man-made hornet, and that kids shouldn't play with it because they'd end up getting stung by accident, and the medicine it carried could make young boys so sick they could die. The black stripes on its see-through body looked scary, like the blue and black hornets I saw flying in the prairie roses, the kind that stung me when I went to see Cook'em Nancy. Dad picked up the hornet, put it near the spoon, and it sucked the medicine into its belly. Then he wrapped his leather belt around his arm and held one end with his teeth, pulling back with his head like my Uncle Paul's dog did whenever we played tug-of-war. I could see green veins on his arm and hands. He jabbed himself with the hornet, and red shot into the hornet's body. I pushed my face right up against the crack, trying to get a better look, as bad butterflies swam all through my guts. It looks just like the red ink that the octopus shot into the ocean right before it escaped the shark, I thought. I wondered if my dad could run away, or if a shark would get him. The softness of Cook'em's voice whispered in my ears as the smell of Saskatoon berries filled my nose. The butterflies flew up my body and out the top of my head. Dad let go of the belt, moaned, and toppled off the edge of the toilet. I pushed the door open and ran to him. He didn't move, and his eyes were closed. I looked back at Josh. He stood in the arch of the doorway, a dark river spreading down the front of his brown corduroys. Trash pandas. The pink neon sign on the corner store drooped down to one side and flickered on and off. The light strobed against the window I was standing in front of, staring at the huge ice cream cone on the advertisement taped against the inside of the glass. "Pay attention, Jesse," Dad said, and pushed my shoulder. Blankets of dead leaves swirled against the building when the wind picked up, and Dad tucked his head into the collar of his jean jacket. I saw an old man wearing a hat approach from the path over near the grass. Dad headed him off by the corner. I tried to focus. "Excuse me, sir," Dad said. "I was wondering if you had some spare change. I got three kids and they haven't eaten today." Dad sounded polite as he motioned over to us, and we stood, hands out with big eyes, just like Dad had taught us. "We'd really appreciate anything." The man peeled his trench coat open, searched his pockets, and shrugged. "Sorry, fella. Don't have change to spare." He moved past us and entered the store. The entrance bell rang. It was a sound that meant defeat and more begging. I watched through the window As he bought milk and bread, he got some change back. When he came out, I ran over and tugged his leg, trying to make his quarters and dimes jingle in his pocket to let him know I knew he had change. He kicked me away. "You should be ashamed," he said to my dad. "Fuck you," Dad fired back and flicked his cigarette in the man's direction. Dad was shivering. Josh sighed and Jerry wrapped his arms around Josh in a bear hug and squeezed until Josh laughed and begged him to stop. Dad was busy searching the sidewalk and found a half-smoked butt near the trash bin. "I'm not eating out of there again," Josh said. His eyes focused on my father and the bin. He kicked the wall. "We're not supposed to." Dad put the butt in his mouth and lifted the lid off the garbage container. "You never know what you're going to find in there." He was right. A couple of days ago, when Dad had taken off, Josh took Jerry, leaving me in the apartment. I'd watched out of our window and could see Jerry as he made a beeline towards the bin, climbed up, and dove in a pool of black trash bags. He looked like a raccoon. After a few minutes, he emerged clutching some old bread, a couple of packs of cold cuts, and a few dented cans. He tossed them to Josh, but Josh fumbled and dropped them like an outfielder having a bad day. The bread and meat were still good, just a little green around the edges. When we picked that off, though, it was as good as new. "Nothing in here, boys. Pickup was last night." Dad shut the bin lid and pulled his collar up. His cigarette went out. The November wind bit through our clothing, and we huddled together. We'd been out for a few hours and hadn't come up with any change. Everyone seemed to be in a rush or didn't have enough to spare. We always shared what we had, and I didn't understand why people were so mean and wouldn't share with us. "Listen," Dad said, "I have a plan." He knelt down in front of Jerry and Josh, placing his hands on their shoulders. "I've done it with Josh before, but we're all here today, so I think it'll work better." Josh perked up, but Dad didn't even glance at me. I stuck my tongue out. Now, you're only three, but you can help too, Jesse." Dad patted my bum. "Josh knows the drill. Just follow behind him and do what he says." Josh put his arms around Jerry and me and pulled us close. "Just stay beside me and run when I tell you," he whispered. "Go straight back to the apartment and don't follow Dad." Dad winked at Josh. "That's right, son." I was so jealous of Josh. I held on to Josh's sleeve when we entered the store. Jerry was right beside me, ogling the rows of chips and candy. The storekeeper looked down at us, but then fixed his eyes on Dad, who walked ahead, leaving us behind. Before I knew it, he was by the milk and pop near the back of the store. His head darted around, down to the floor, over to the chocolate bars, up to the lights, like he didn't know what he was looking for. Inch by inch, Josh nudged us closer and closer to the first aisle near the front door. I'd never seen Dad move like that, like a freaked-out squirrel. He looked scared and funny all at once, opening and closing doors. Suddenly, he disappeared. I stood on my tippy-toes to see what he was up to. Smash! A river of milk flowed out from the dairy section. It was followed by the noise of another broken bottle. "What's going on over there?" the storekeeper shouted as he came out from behind the till and went to investigate. I was looking in the direction of the milk aisle, trying to catch a glimpse of Dad, but Josh pulled me close, yanked open my drawers, and stuffed in a few bags of chips, a handful of pepperettes, and a loaf of bread. I was shocked, food sticking halfway out of my waistband. Jerry was already at the door 10 feet away, holding it open, his pants too, bulging to the brim with goodies. Josh pulled my shirt and nudged me towards Jerry. I stumbled a few steps before Jerry grabbed my arm and walked me out the front door. When our shoes touched the sidewalk outside, he pivoted toward the trash bin and dragged me until I almost fell flat on my face. The bell in the door rang as it closed behind us. Josh hurried by with a bunch of gum in one hand and licorice and more pepperettes in the other. He directed us to a cedar bush a couple of feet behind the bin. We nestled under the cover of the branches and waited for Dad. When he emerged from the store, he was flailing his arms and arguing with the storekeeper. The storekeeper screamed back, waving around a mop, pointing back at the store. Dad skipped backwards a few steps, then took off towards the park. No one noticed us, watching through the bushes' boughs. I thought this was fun. I was happy to be working together with everyone, and now we had tons of food. A Father's Love. I dreamed of my birth, all wet from the womb, blinding light overhead, emergency room. Behind newborn cries, my little hands grasped. A son called the doc, while my tiny lungs gasped. Oh, happy day, my mother did cry. Come, let me hold him, a tear in my dad's eye. The strength of father's arms, tight around me, he swayed back and forth, his love did surround me. Then, out of nowhere, dad yanked with a dash. Swung by my legs, he chucked me right in the trash. Don't need that, he laughed and slammed down the lid. He dusted his hand. Who the fuck needs a kid? The Red Baron. Dad didn't come home again last night, Josh said, as he jumped off the top bunk, thudding down on the wooden floor. He began rocking the lower bunk. Its rusty spring squeaked with each push. Jerry groaned and pulled the covers over his body, exposing my legs. The chill of the morning air through the holes in my Mighty Mouse PJ bottoms jolted me wide awake. Jerry took up 3/4 of the bottom bunk, which I shared with him, but that was okay. Even if I only got the outside sliver of the mattress to sleep on, because his body was warm and soft and reminded me of a teddy bear. I yawned and rubbed my stomach. I know, Josh said. That's why I'm trying to get you up. Dad took off with all the change when he woke up. He said he'd come back with food, but hasn't. He shoved the bunk again, this time hard enough to wake Jerry, who let out a fart. He lay on his side, still curled into a ball, his mouth and chin covered in drool. A pool of it drenched the pillow below. Jerry's crusty eyes blinked open and he looked towards the living room. Where's Dad? He sounded angry and annoyed. I don't know. Josh threw up his hands. And we've got no food again. I could hear Jerry's stomach grumble as he sat up slowly with the blanket tight around his shoulders. It looked like a cape. I watched as the World War I airplanes that decorated its fuzzy surface folded and contorted and collided into one another. I imagined mid-air explosions all across his back. I knew they were fighter planes because Dad told us they were. He said the ones with the black crosses on the tails were the Germans, the bad guys, and the ones with the blue, white, and red bullseye were the British, the good guys. I loved the story of the Red Baron and always imagined myself in his three-winged plane shooting down Canadian ace Roy Brown. The Baron's plane was cooler than Brown's by a long shot. Both the Baron's red Fokker DRI triplane and Brown's Sopwith Camel buzzed around Jerry's neck when he stood up and shuffled into the kitchen. He slammed the cupboard doors in frustration and collapsed on the floor crying, "I'm hungry!" he wailed repeatedly. Josh abandoned me. Don't cry, Jerry, he said, going to him and rubbing his back. We're going to go over to the store and get some food like last week. He looked over at the window I knew faced the convenience store. With all three of us out there, we'll get all kinds of stuff. It'll be fun. Josh went to the fridge and grabbed one of the half-drunk beers and gave it to Jerry. Brown Pop, drink it. Jerry dropped the blanket and took the bottle with both hands. He scrunched up his face, put the bottle to his lips, tilted his head back, and swallowed. I pictured him drinking a magic potion. Jerry's the toughest of us all, I thought. Gross, Jerry let out. He hated Brown Pop and never drank them when Dad gave them to us, but he knew it would fill him up. He handed the empty back to Josh, who went to place it under the kitchen sink with the others. When he opened the door, cockroaches scurried into the darkest corners of the cupboard. We also got this, Josh said as he walked back to the fridge, a glimmer of enthusiasm in his voice. The turnip he pulled from the crisper was as big as his head, and the thump it made when it hit the floor shook our apartment. It sounded like a bomb went off. Josh rolled the clumsy boulder over to the edge of the warplanes, hitting Jerry's foot. Dad said we could eat this. I know we tried before, but we gave up too easy, Josh said. I waddled over to the vegetable, wondering how it'd fit in my mouth. Josh pulled a knife out of a drawer and sat down and began to hack at the turnip. Flecks of white and hard yellow the size of pennies flew in all directions as Josh whacked away at it. I put one of the white pieces in my mouth and bit down, but my teeth couldn't meet all the way. I chewed away. It tasted like nothing, but I swallowed anyways. I rubbed my fingers along my bottom teeth. They were covered in a waxy film. Jerry picked up a yellow piece and chucked it in his mouth. The click of his jaw told me the yellow parts were way harder than the white ones. He folded his arms and spat the piece out on the ground. It's worse than brown pops. It's like rock. I can't eat that. Josh's blade paused a second as he took a big yellow piece and placed it in his mouth. He tried to look like he was happy eating it, but we could tell it was torture. The muscles on the side of his head flexed and bulged. He spat it out and agreed with Jerry. Totally inedible. There was a loud knock at the door. Josh gently placed the knife on the ground and put his hands over our mouths. Be quiet, he mouthed and made a shush shape with his lips. The battle-scarred turnip rocked back and forth, threatening to give us away. Another knock assaulted the door. Open up, a voice boomed. It's the police. We know you boys are in there. Josh's eyes widened, and he grabbed my shirt and pulled me toward the wall, as if he didn't know what to do or where to go. Jerry shot up, tossing the blanket on the floor. Come with me, he said as he launched me and Josh into the bedroom. We skidded over to Jerry's hiding spot, a large vent in our room that he'd discovered when we first moved in. When he showed it to Dad, he was impressed with how much room there was inside. Jerry told him how he'd used a penny to turn the screws at the corners to take the grate off, and how the shaft went straight 12 feet and then turned right. Smart lad, Dad said. He tied a string to the back of the grate. Now, when someone comes, and I mean anyone, you all pile in here and just pull this string. It'll close the vent cover behind you. Got it? Jerry nodded and tried it out. The first couple times the cover went on crooked or sideways or not at all. Eventually, though, with enough coaching from Dad, Jerry could pull it closed in a second or two. From the outside, it was hard to see the string or that the screws weren't holding the grate on. Boom, boom, boom. The knocks at the door turned into what sounded like powerful kicks. It was only a matter of minutes before the door gave way. Hurry, they're coming, Jerry said as he pulled the grate off and rammed my head through the vent opening. He kicked my bum to hurry me up. A wall of warm, dry air slammed into my face and arms as I flew down the shaft. Josh was right behind me, pressing his face into my ass. He shoved me farther down the shaft towards the darkness. Go, 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 he commanded in a frantic but hushed voice. Faster, Jesse, crawl faster. The more we wiggled forward, the more our bodies dented the tin walls. It sounded like thunder all around my head. I began to cry. I looked back and could see Jerry pull the string closed. The grate slapped into place in one shot, perfect, just like Dad had taught him. We covered our mouths to silence our breath, dust settling all around us. Boom, boom, boom! I could hear the front door burst open and footsteps stampede into the living room. It sounded like the herds of bison stampeding that I'd seen on nature shows. Look at this, I heard one man say. The kitchen is full of trash. Hey, look, called another out from the bathroom, his voice echoing off the tiles. There are rigs and gear in the tub. Check it out. One voice stood out from the rest. I could tell he was in charge. Yep. Just like the neighbor described, dope and children. Find them. The violent sound of crashing cupboard doors was followed by the clanking of empty beer bottles. "Jesus," a deep voice said from near the kitchen. "They've been hacking up this turnip. They've got no food." I heard them go into Dad's room and then more noise. "Nothing in here but skin magazines." A pair of black boots appeared in front of the vent, and someone bent down to look under the bed. It was a police officer. I could just see his uniform past Jerry and Josh's bodies. "Nothing in here," he said, as he shone a flashlight into the vent. His voice was higher and younger than the rest. "But the pillow was wet. They must have just left." "Not possible," the voice in charge said. "The lady next door watched him leave last night at 10:30 and the kids were inside. She saw them herself when she peeked in from the door across the hall. She said they begged for food in front of the store or the arena. We checked both locations, and they weren't there. That means they're still here. Look harder." "I don't know, Sarge. We checked everywhere. It's a tiny apartment. Where else could they be?" Jerry's arms were shaking as the black boots readjusted in front of the vent. A radio chattered as Josh squirmed. The tin made a muffled knock under his arms. "Wait a minute," the high voice said. "I think they're in here." The front of the vent shifted as he dug his fingers under the grate and tried to pull. Jerry gritted his teeth and held it tight with all his might. "They're in the vent. I can see them. But they've got it locked off somehow." The herd of black boots entered the room as the young officer's eye peered in to get a better look. "Yep." He smiled and put his palm up to the vent holes. I was shaking, and I could feel Josh was too. "It's okay, fellas. Nothing to be afraid of. Move out of the way," the lead voice barked, and the grate ripped off. A huge, meaty hand with hair on it reached in and pulled Jerry out, then Josh and me, my Mighty Mouse PJs ripping on a screw in the opening. Jerry and I were shaking and crying. I couldn't speak. The string had rubbed Jerry's palms raw as it was torn from his grasp. Red and blue lights flashed against the ceiling of our bedroom. "Dad is going to kill us," I thought. Josh began to cry. He was probably thinking the same thing. The officer who found us bent down and smiled. "Which one are you?" he asked Josh, as he dusted the lint off my brother's shoulder and wiped his tears. Josh just glared at him and kept his mouth shut, the dust on his face now smeared to the back of his ear. A kind-looking black woman with a clipboard emerged from behind the young policeman. I could smell her fruity perfume. It made me hungry. She knelt in front of Jerry. "We're going to take you somewhere safe. There's no need to be afraid." Jerry pushed her away and crossed his arms. She nodded to the police, and they scooped us up. As the officer carried me out of the apartment, I looked over his shoulder and saw my blanket sitting on the kitchen floor. It half covered the turnip and some empty bottles. I could see the edge of the Baron's triplane, and I imagined myself flying it higher and higher into the sky, up near the sun. The Pact. The nice black lady and the young police officer took us to a large red brick building with lots of windows. "You boys will be safe here," she said. She took Jerry by the hand from the squad car. Jerry didn't put up a fight, neither did Josh or I. We walked through a pair of giant steel doors that guarded the front entrance and down a long hall into a large room with rows and rows of bunk beds. It smelled of bleach. There were other kids there. They sat on their bunks and checked us out as we walked to three empty beds at the back of the room. Josh and Jerry got bottom bunks, I got the top. I noticed two black kids and a few older kids who had dark skin and hair like us. They looked like our Indian cousins in Saskatchewan, but different. The covers and sheets of the beds were done up perfectly, corners tucked tight under the mattresses, the pillows flat and smoothed out. I'd seen Mom make a bed that way, but we'd been with Dad for months and he never did anything like that for us, and he couldn't afford these kinds of pillows. I was relieved at the order and cleanliness of this new place, whatever it was. "This is Children's Aid," the black lady told us. Through the tangle of bedposts, I saw a red-headed boy looking at me. He flashed me a smile and a tiny wave. I ducked down and buried my head in the black lady's leg. "That's Johnny," she said. "He's a nice boy. No need to be shy." Josh and Jerry peered over, and the boy again smiled and waved. They stared at him until his hand fell by his side. The place was way bigger than our apartment or any of the places I'd ever been. "Where's Dad, and when is he coming to get us?" Josh asked. The black lady just gave us something to eat and tucked us all in and left, turning the lights out. I wasn't scared and fell asleep, my belly full. I dreamt about the black lady and wondered what her name was. When I woke in the morning, the place buzzed with activity, and we were ushered in lines into a hall where we had oatmeal and bananas. I stuck by my brothers as the other kids checked us out. Josh did all the talking, telling everyone that our dad was away and that we'd be going home as soon as the police found him. "I used to think that too," one kid said, "but we're orphans now. Don't you know?" I didn't know what that meant. We became good friends with Johnny and the other kids. Jerry said Johnny was like our red-headed brother, and that he was part of our tribe too. Johnny told us that his parents couldn't afford Cheerios one day, had a big fight over it, and then dropped him off here. He said he felt like it was his fault, that he never got the chance to tell his parents that he didn't even like Cheerios, and that they'd be okay without cereal. I was sorry for him. I thought the same about why my mom and dad had left us. I'd been a bad boy and had asked for food too often. We'd eaten Dad's secret food too many times, and he'd probably gotten so mad over it that he'd up and left us. I gave Johnny a hug. After a few days, strange things started happening. The black lady and other people who worked in the big building started taking kids out of the large room one by one. They asked them all kinds of difficult questions. Doctors examined them for any bugs and sicknesses, checked their hair and tongue, in their underwear and under their arms, or so we were told by the kids when they returned. Some were taken out and never came back. That was the scariest. It was like they'd been eaten by monsters. No one knew what happened to them, but the older kids said that they were the lucky ones because someone wanted them. I didn't understand that. Our mom and dad wanted us. Why didn't theirs want them too? When they came for Jerry, Josh rushed over and bit the lady on the hand, and I ran and kicked her foot as hard as I could. We screamed and screamed, fought and fought, our faces getting redder than fire engines. Johnny joined in, stomping on her toe until she let go. We four scurried to the back of the room and nestled into a corner. Josh grabbed hold of our necks and pulled us in close. We locked arms and brought Johnny in too, holding tight to one another, gnashing our teeth. We did exactly as Dad had directed, protected each other from strangers. The woman left the room to get help. "We gotta stick together," Josh said, panting. We all nodded. We made a pact then and there to take care of one another no matter what. We squeezed each other with all our might and shut our eyes, sealing the deal. 5 minutes after the pact was struck, a team of workers came in and wrestled Johnny from our circle. We tried fighting back, but they held us down and took away our red-headed brother. They were just too strong. We never saw Johnny again. I thought of him when they came and got us three brothers a few weeks later. Monster Rescue. "You boys are lucky," the black lady said to me, after I'd been checked over by the doctor and placed in the hallway with my brothers. "We found a foster home that will take all three of you." Josh stood on defense between the front entrance and the door of the large room. Jerry milled about. He was silent, biting his nails. "Take us?" Josh asked forcefully. "Where? What about our mom and dad?" Jerry's face went blank and he stopped pacing. He moved behind Josh, as if to back him up. "What does foster home mean?" I never heard that word before. Who was going to take us? I wasn't sure, but I knew my brothers were uneasy. The lady hesitated, and I could tell she was thinking hard about what she was going to say next. The doctor came into the hall and handed a clipboard to her. "They're all clear," he said, "but this one's still a little underweight." He pointed to Josh. He looked fine to me. Josh asked more questions, but we got no answers about our dad or mom. The lady just kept telling us that we were lucky and that our ride to our new home would be along shortly. We were cleaned up, teeth brushed, hair combed, shoes tied, and had our belongings packed up. I had the leather Adidas bag Mom had given me before Dad took us from Saskatchewan, and Jerry and Josh had theirs too. Our names were on them, and we always kept them ready just in case we had to run at night. It was a fun game Dad played with us when we moved. The police must have brought them when we first came to the red brick building, but they forgot to bring our old clothes. I was glad to hold my bag again. It meant I was going somewhere new, and it was filled with better clothes now, even a brand new Mighty Mouse t-shirt. I was excited even though I knew my brothers were worried. We went outside, and an old man drove up and got out of his car. He said, "Nice to see you, Gladys," to the black lady, and told us his name was Clive. He smelled like old cigars and had grease on his overalls. He was way bigger than Dad, and I thought he was at least 100 years old, judging by his gray hair and fat belly. Gladys shook Clive's hand, then knelt down and pinched Jerry's cheek. "I'll miss you, boys," she said, picking the lint off his yellow and brown striped sweater. "But I'll miss you the most, Jerry." I could see he almost burst into tears. They hugged while Clive loaded our bags into the trunk of his car, and with that we were off. The car ride to our new house took forever. We drove until nighttime, and I couldn't keep my eyes open. When we pulled up to Clive's place, a woman and girl came out to greet us. They had big smiles and balloons, and a small dog was barking its head off beside them. It was about the size of a beaver and had scraggly brown hair. "This is my wife, Cynthia," Clive said, "and my daughter, Matilda." Cynthia looked so old to me, like Clive, and Matilda was around the same age as my cousin Suzanne back in Saskatoon, around 9 years old. Her hair was curly down to her shoulders. I could see her braces when she smiled. The dog continued to bark and sniff as we made our way inside. My memories of the time inside that house are misty, like a shroud of fog not yet lifted just before dawn, the wild shape of things black and blue bleeding into one another, the sunlight not yet strong enough to make out what lurks in the tall azure grass ahead, the line of spruce just out of view at the other end of the meadow. What I do remember, though, is grease, pressure, that yapping dog, and wishing it would end. I remember my brother Jerry fighting off the giant wolf that came into our room and floated over our beds and ripped him apart. Jerry's tiny fist punched up into the darkness right before his little body was dug out and broken. He would put himself between me and the monster. He would rescue me from whatever it was that had him and Josh squealing in the next room while I cried myself to sleep. I would turn my head and try to hide from it all, but it always found me. Jerry and Josh changed after that. They lost their superpowers. They peed the bed every night, but they were still my protectors. The fragments of that time blend and reflect light in a way that blinds me. But I do know that one day the black lady showed up, and that before we left the house, Josh shut the door in the dog's face. Its whining is the last thing I remember from that horrible place. The Beast. We raced by juts of rock and small jack pines. My eyes tried to keep up with the jagged landscape, but the blurred tracers of green and black just made me sick. My grandparents, Searle and Jackie Thistle, looked exactly like they did in the pictures Dad used to show us. Grandpa, who was driving, had a brown mustache like Dad's, but it was trimmed neatly around his upper lip. His hair was slick and parted like Alfalfa's from Little Rascals, but not down the middle. Grandma had a gray-black afro that wobbled with the motion of the van. She leaned back to offer me a sandwich. I was hungry, so I took it. Grandpa smiled at me in the rearview mirror. His eyes gleamed like blue sapphires, the light catching them just so through his glasses. My grandparents didn't say much to us boys on the drive to Toronto, but I could make out that my grandmother was mad at my parents by the way she complained to Grandpa. Her fury at our dad for leaving us alone. Her anger when she talked about our mother. I didn't understand that, though. Dad had talked Mom into letting us go in Moose Jaw. It wasn't her fault the way things ended up. As Grandma railed on, I realized there was a force in her that was more powerful than that of my grandfather. Grandpa listened and nodded, careful to watch the road, but it was clear that Grandma was in charge. In between sentences, Grandma turned to face me, and, with the taste of ham and cheese thick on my tongue, I could smell the scent of charred wood and tobacco coming from her direction. Somehow the odor told me I could trust her enough to share my words. "Thank you for the sandwich, Grandma." She rubbed my leg. "You're welcome, baby boy." She peeled an orange, and I shared it with Jerry and Josh, who fell asleep soon after. But I remained awake, fascinated by my grandma and her campfire smell. I stared at her as she smoked her cigarettes and flicked them in an empty coffee cup she kept between her knees. I'd later learned from my aunties that Grandma's people came from a place way up in northern Ontario called Temiskaming, and that she was part Native and part white like us boys, Algonquin and Scottish, and that her dad was from a reserve near Notre-Dame-du-Nord in Quebec. As I examined her features through the cigarette smoke, I recognized that Grandma was a little Indian, but her hair was all curly, not black and straight like my mom's and auntie's out west. Her skin was more tan than my grandfather's. He had the same tone as a freshly opened can of Spam, pink through and through, like Dad and me, not Grandma. She was lighter than Josh, but almost looked the same beige mix as Jerry. "Look," Grandpa said after hours of driving along what seemed like a never-ending road. We crested a hill and the landscape opened up before us. "That's Toronto. That's where our house is." He lifted his bare paw from the wheel and pointed to a cluster of buildings on the approaching horizon. The toothy jumble of concrete in the distance was unlike anything I'd seen before, way bigger than anywhere else I'd ever been. "You see that needle-looking structure right in the middle?" Grandpa asked. "That's the tallest building in the world, the CN Tower." I almost fell forward off my seat trying to get a better look. Grandpa laughed. "We live over there," he said, motioning to a smaller cluster of buildings, "in a place called Brampton. But I'll take you boys to see the tower after we're all settled in." The houses in Brampton were set in neat little rows with perfect lawns and freshly paved roads. Everything looked so clean, orderly, and taken care of. Blue jays and robins sang to each other in the treetops. Squirrels ran everywhere collecting things, and cats walked, sure-footed, along fence tops. There was so much sunlight. It comforted me to see so many parents walking with their kids. I thought of my mom and dad, but in a good way, when we were happy and together. This new place was so beautiful. We rounded the corner, pulled into a driveway on the coziest street I ever saw, and Grandpa declared, "We're home." "Just be careful of Yorkie," Grandma said as we got out and made our way to the front door. "He likes to jump." Bounding out the door came a beast of a dog. He had brown and black fur with flecks of silver down the sides, and his ears were erect like a German shepherd's. He looked like a wolf and stood as tall as the middle of my chest. His tail wagged so hard that his bum shot from side to side, even while he charged at us. He leapt at me and I fell backwards, and he started licking my face until I couldn't breathe. I started to cry. But Yorkie kept licking, yelping with glee. He was doing his best to welcome us home.